Welcome to Weekly Wings, your go-to podcast from DroneLife.com, where we soar through the latest in drone technology, regulation updates, and exciting innovations. Each week, join Samuel, Terry, and I as we navigate the drone industry, offering expert insights, interviews with key figures, and a bird's eye view of how drones are shaping our world. From commercial applications to recreational adventures, Weekly Wings delves deep into how these remarkable vehicles are impacting construction, education, filmmaking, agriculture, delivery services, and more. Whether you're a professional drone operator, a hobbyist, or just drone curious, tune in to stay informed and inspired as we explore the heights of what's possible in the world of drones. Subscribe now and never miss an episode of Weekly Wings, where the future is looking up. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Another week. How's everybody doing?
Pretty good. Thanks for asking. That intro is actually pretty good. I like the sound of that. I think you're getting it down to a T. Kind of just a note to our viewers, we don't have that pre-recorded just yet, so kind of impressed he did that all in one take.
It sounds like it, though. We'll just box that up. I feel like I could just see the drone videos, like the ocean waves crashing. Really excited today. Lots going on as always in the industry, and it's really amazing in such a short period of time. So we're going to be talking maybe a little bit about space weather here. Big old KP solar storm had everybody talking about that and how it's impact on GPS. Featured topic we'll discuss is the possibility of an Army drone branch. Tech Spotlight, we'll be looking at a few different things. One, the Zephyr flight simulator, really, really cool software product available right on a computer. You know, you can use an Xbox, PS4 remote, also a drone controller that has the ability to plug an interface directly into the computer to get some stick time in on that simulation. And then we'll be discussing a industry survey that's available. So folks that are tuning in that are doing this from a business standpoint, that are conducting drone operations, training, sales, services, manufacturing, software, hardware production, any of that. There's a drone survey, industry survey out that you may be interested in completing. And on the regulatory side, we will be discussing a subcommittee meeting that is happening tomorrow on the use of drones in emergency management and emergency response. So that should be really exciting. You got folks from AUVSI that are going to be testifying and speaking to the use of drones in the public safety space to help drive some of this regulatory development. So really exciting episode, some great information to bring today. But I guess just to touch on right here, got a little handheld, receiver here for some GPS stuff. Use this as a base station or a rover. Solar Storm. What do you guys think about this Solar Storm? This thing that happened?
Honestly, like, go ahead, Terry.
I was just saying it was very pretty.
Oh, you leave it at that.
Terry, you said, like, I didn't even see it. So I didn't even see it. You know, I was whatever, one thing or another, whether it was kids or so, studying space right now, trying to get that, complete that education. So I've learned a lot over the past year plus, and still got a few more classes left, but I've just been learning about space, launch, LEO, satellites. So when things like this happen and then I miss it, and it's like all you had to do is step outside and you kind of could have seen it. And it sucks. But so cool to be able to see this, but then also understanding like what is happening. Samuel?
Yeah, kind of just touching on what Terry said. It was, in fact, very pretty, not to rub it in your face, Paul. I wouldn't have even noticed either if Terry hadn't texted me some photos of it live. And I'm like, what is this? And a little bit of research later, I'm outside taking photos of my own. But I honestly, it's kind of crazy. I don't know how much of a notice everyone had, because I wouldn't have known either unless Terry had said something. And it seemed, I guess I had seen it in an article about a week before, but it just kind of flew to the back of my head until later when Terry told me about it. But it seems like it heavily impacted a significant amount of operations for GPS, the things that are reliant on GPS. Like, if you were going to fly your drone, it probably would not have a very accurate GPS reading. I think you mentioned something about tractors too that were reliant on GPS. And in today's, I'm trying to think the right word, in today's life and pretty much everyday life, you're using your GPS typically. So having that impacted to the where it's not working properly, that's kind of a huge deal for us, even if it's just 24 hours, 48 hours of it being impacted. But a little bit for me.
And yeah, you see that with the solar storm and the farmers' tractors that you mentioned, which shared on the screen right here. And then also, you know, the NOAA, National Weather Service. This is, you know, what you're seeing on the screen is just that image of the sun, the solar flare visualization, the coronal mass ejects, and then how that impacts the magnetic fields right around Earth. And so there's a lot of great resources. And this, all of a sudden, there's more drones, there's more tractors, there's more, if I go back, right, we've got this chart here. There's more vehicles leveraging GPS than ever before. So if there was ever going to be a sense of like, hey, what, seeing an impact, the more there are in use. And then when we have this massive, you know, geomagnetic storm that occurs, you have more users or more receivers online than ever. And you have one of the most significant conditions to have occurred since this number of vehicles are online. And so it's interesting, you know, seeing folks report about the John Deere stuff. How much was it really effective? Was it one tractor, two tractors? There's a lot of things at play there. But again, this is something that folks are just kind of starting to look at, because drones use and rely on GPS, and there's more drones in operation than ever. But I think it's a really neat and exciting for someone like myself to know that. Again, I think, as I've been sharing, is there's a huge overlap here between space and not just drones, but vehicles in the ground. So we're, you know, the importance of space, understanding space, valuing space, and you know, understanding it is important. So when those geomagnetic storms occur, it causes changes in the, you know, the Earth's atmosphere and the ionosphere, which impacts the communication and the data that's talking to the receiver itself. So RTK is in place, right, in order to help correct some of those variations in real time. But if you have such massive variations, again, it's quite possible that you're pushing the capabilities of this, you know, RTK function, which again is never is not being tested with these types of magnetic storms on a regular basis.
I did want to jump in real quick and just kind of preface for the listeners and viewers that this isn't a normal storm. This was a storm like this hasn't hit since, I believe, in like 20 years. Like, this was a relatively significant storm, and that's why it's so heavily impacted the GPS and everything like this. So I just kind of want to throw that out there that it wasn't necessarily faulty technology. Due to a small storm, this was relatively significant.
Yeah, just to put this out there so you can visualize it, kind of. The last time there was a storm this big was a year before I was born. So
give some good context.
Kind of like the floods, I guess. People can visualize like a 100-year floodplain, the 500-year floodplain, from the sense of this could happen, but again, the likelihood of it to occur and what is the risk. So I think information was learned, data was kind of collected, but it's also going to be a challenge to continue to understand exactly what happened when you can't just recreate, at least not, you know, at a readily available means, recreate these types of conditions. And with that, transitioning to...
We'll be sure to text you as well next time, Paul, so you can go outside, get some photos.
Well, that Terry did, but like, what is this pictures of? I was very, very confused.
You give him context, Terry, or do you just send a picture?
You can't really, you couldn't really see it with your eyes. Your phone definitely picked it up better than your eyes did. So.
I couldn't see anything at all with my eyes.
Yeah, it's just, I seen like light red, kind of hues of purple. It wasn't too much.
I guess it also depends on the light pollution too, probably, right? That would be kind of one of my assumptions.
I saw some really good photos. And there was this one site, like all of a sudden that was just all these amazing photos, but it was really hard to tell if these photos had been, you know, slightly edited or not edited at all. But they all looked really cool. It's clicking. I need a silent mouse. So, moving along, for listeners here that have any, you know, military connections or interests, maybe currently serving, just like we saw the recent development of the, you know, Space Force and recognizing again the here what's trending. Oh, space is trending, right? Recognizing the changes and really the ones that are happening, you know, day by day, is the integration and use of, you know, small unmanned aircraft systems in that the contemporary operating environment these days, what we've seen in Ukraine, in Israel. And so it looks like, you know, there's this possibility that, you know, maybe the Army will create a drone branch in order to continue to adapt and keep up with this ever-changing operational environment.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised. So, I feel like that would be something like the Air Force, but I guess that most of the operators for drones are currently just Army as far as I'm tracking, but I guess having its own separate branch kind of would make sense to specialize in something like that, especially because drones are becoming so prevalent in warfare.
Yeah, well, they're probably wanting to use it on the front lines and like be interconnected. The Army's kind of like a Swiss army knife, no pun intended, but like they can do a little bit of everything, and the Air Force is kind of like particularly like the big boy, the aerial stuff, for more or less. So they want this to be like on the ground to like do reconnaissance or whatever for their squads, most likely.
And then also the what's super, you know, important here is the counter UAS aspect of it. So the swarm drones being able to not just operate, Terry mentioned, on the you know, to deploy this at the very front line, but also to defend it at the front line. So what equipment needs to be, you know, deployed, carried, readily available for soldiers, and understanding how it all ties together. You got to have a lot of plug and place, you know, operational equipment in the military, but you got to have trained folks that understand how to improvise and adapt the technology in, you know, in that war fighting environment. So the counter side and the operational aspect, the maneuver center of excellence. So I think the technology is well developed, but to balance, like, you know, you have a group of folks that are all kind of specifically trained to integrate that piece into the fight. So it's kind of neat, I guess. And it's weird because you have aviation, right? But when you look at aviation, the branch itself, it's more large aircraft. It's lots of soldiers working on specific aircraft, and it's not at, none of it's really at the front line.
I would say, I'll just kind of jump in, for the U.S. military, who would be operating those aircraft typically? Like, what branch specifically? Manned, I'm talking about.
Okay, yeah, so that's a really good question. So when you think Air Force, everybody always thinks fly, aviation.
That's right? What I thought,
but
yeah.
Air Force is going to be, yeah, Air Force is going to be your fixed wing. Like, heavy, if you look, do the research on the numbers, the majority of the Air Force's aircraft are going to be large, fixed wing aircraft for logistics and transport. The Army is going to have the majority of your rotor wing aircraft, helicopters. So just like boats too, like there's this weird thing where the Army, I think, has more boats than the Navy, because the Navy doesn't have boats. The Navy has ships, right? The Navy has battleships. The Army doesn't have battleships, but the Army has a lot of little boats and things to move stuff logistically. Whereas the Navy, they're going to take you to war with their rigs,
those massive battleships,
like an aircraft carrier.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not a boat, right? So they don't have the most boats, which is most people go, what do you mean? So that then the Marines, you're going to have a combination fixed wing jet aircraft and rotorcraft helicopters. But the Marines is not the largest of the branch by size. So a real combination of all flying aircraft, just not a high volume. And then what, the Navy? And then when you look at the Navy, that's where you've got fighter jets. Navy pilots are operating jets off of the aircraft carriers.
So kind
of that nature.
As it stands right now, if you were going to get a drone job in the military, you would probably go to the Army, right? Relatively speaking.
Yep, you would be in the military. Because you're going to be operating the larger Predator, Shadow, Reaper, whatever is in that operation at this point, which is going to be, you know, deployed by an Army unit at a local level and maintained. And then exactly where the pilot sensor operator is, it's kind of global. So it's a bit different, especially because you're going to run the flight ops 24/7. And it can be tactically positioned anywhere, just like any other drone operation. You can maintain and manage and keep the vehicle here, and then it's piloted off-site from a box. I don't want to call it a box, but I think when you think military, you basically have a operational container that it's readily deployable. I think strategically it's the Army, those frontline soldiers, that could value the most from that short range reconnaissance, you know, put it out in front of a convoy, get it out ahead, integrate some different sensors and technologies for earth movement detection. Just a lot of neat things. And so a branch, and then again, it's like eight, if now you have that drone branch, it's really interesting because it's, the way that a student or someone growing up might now see the occupation as opposed to aviation specifically.
And kind of off topic, you said aircraft carrier, and I remember seeing something earlier about China building the world's first drone aircraft carrier. I don't know how true this is. I think it's kind of, it's just not reported really yet, but there is kind of, there's a little bit of info suggesting that it is a drone aircraft carrier. So, I mean, that's pretty cool.
Well, I see. So you're saying like it's like the vehicle itself is autonomous, the aircraft carrier. You could actually.
I would like to think.
So we're going to have the carrier, right? The ship itself is going to be remotely operated, and then you're going to be putting, you know, remotely piloted jet aircraft launching and recovering from it. Everyone will be behind there.
There's not very much information on this bad boy yet, but it has two large drone motherships apparently that they kind
of sit off. You got a video? You got a photo of it up?
I have a link. It's a satellite photo of a shipyard. So.
Oh.
Like I said, there's not very much information on it. I put it in the Discord if you want to look at it.
Yeah, we'll have to do some deeper diving on that, Terry. So moving on, you know, talked a little about that, the RTK and the space weather stuff and the, you know, Army launching a drone branch. And, you know, that's the really interesting stuff. That's what you would end up learning. If you went to, you know, your MOS, you're going to end up as a, you know, small unmanned aircraft systems integrator, counter UAS systems integrator. You're going to end up going to that, your basic training, and then you're going to go through your advanced, whatever AIT, your advanced individual training. And there you're going to learn about space weather. Oh my gosh, how cool is that? Because we're learning how it impacts drone operations. So pretty neat stuff. But transitioning, moving on, drone. Yeah, go ahead.
One quick thing before we switched, out of curiosity, I don't know if you know this, I should probably look it up, but what is a cruising altitude of something like a fixed wing drone for the military or the Army per se? Like, because, you know, us casual civilian drone pilots were cruising at 200, 300, 400 feet. Not quite 400, you know. But I'm just, I don't know, giving a frame of reference, because this isn't just your normal drone. It's a beefy drone that can stay up in the air quite a long time doing stuff us civilians never probably ever would.
Oh, yeah. The current capabilities is, you know, 10,000, 12,000, 15,000 feet, even higher, because you're using the same, you know, hardware to build the vehicle, but you don't have to have those additional systems in place for that, the life support of humans on board. And then you're really maxing your altitude out based on the quality of the payloads and sensors on board. So even those military aircraft, if they cost $1 million, $2 million, $3 million, half that cost is likely going into the payload itself, which is going to have some really high quality zoom. So again, it's balancing how high you want the vehicle to go in order to be undetected, maintain some discreetness, but still see what you need to see.
Right.
But well above the 400 feet as far as...
I can see why you would want to study all that space weather.
But then when you look at the branch, when they're launching this Army branch, I think the focus is not... The other drones, these larger drones for a while will likely stay in the current, you know, framework. However, you're going to see the launch of this more smaller drone that is operating below 400 feet. These small weaponized drones, right? These learning how to operate drones that are in swarms. That's what this branch is going to be all about. The newest, latest, you know, all the stuff that's happening in the Ukraine. And I always thought it would be like, I had done this research. One of the proposed businesses for the studies that I'm doing that had to do with low Earth orbit was like a deployable cube. So imagine if you could just launch from an aircraft, like a box, and it would parachute down, it would land safely, or you could drop it off the back of a truck, but like a cube. And then inside of that would be a bunch of small drones, and it could just sit there for a month, 2 months, 3 months, a year. And a year later, you could kind of activate the drones in a swarm or one by one. And it would go out and recon an area or conduct some type of military operation. So it would just sit there for a very long time. But if you use satellite communications, you could potentially activate it at a moment's notice. So when they talk about this Army drone branch, like that's the, I'd like to think that that technology will exist where it's like fully remote. You are never in that location, yet you see everything as if you were standing there. So, anywho, Zephyr Simulator.
Moving on to Zephyr the next Simulator. Topic.
What do you think about that? Yeah, only so much time. And so folks on that commercial side, even, you know, folks in the military that are currently flying larger drones and don't have, you know, experience with the smaller unmanned systems, folks who are looking to get their 107 or getting into flying, but don't have a drone, what can you do in order to gain some flight experience? Littering. And so what could you do, right? You could buy a drone, you could meet someone, make friends, befriend somebody with a drone and fly theirs. But there's the simulation aspect, and simulators have been in use, right, for like FPV, the first person flying simulator, so that you don't have to crash build, repeat crash build. So, you know, we know folks like Tony Bracco, shout out to, Milkman, right?
The Milkman FPV.
The Milkman FPV. So if you're an FPV pilot and you want to see some phenomenal FPV racing, it's at the Milkman FPV, I think. Tony, incredible FPV pilot. But if you talk to those folks, they've been able to use a flight simulator to kind of hone their skills. And that hasn't really existed for, you know, the traditional, civilian market. And now what we're here to talk about and what I've had a chance to actually use and get hands-on stick time with, and then also, you know, more recently, my nephew, I was like, hey, here, take this and fly. And he's all confused. He's like, he was crashing. And he's like, oh, the sticks are backwards. I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, oh, I fly like this. So like a couple button clicks and I was able to switch the PlayStation. I was using a PS4 remote, Bluetooth to a laptop. And I switched to mode 3 sticks and he was doing the obstacle course in under 45 seconds, you know, and in a matter, it took him no time to get it. But if you took the drone remote first and tried to go outside, the you know, intimidated, the lack of confidence would be there. So having used this and seen, you know, the visual, right, how well it looks. This is Zephyr. So Zephyr flight simulator is phenomenal. It's, you know, it's not just does it look good and then it works with the remote, but the ease of downloading it and getting it onto a device and getting it to come up and operate was very seamless and straightforward. So really excited about this product for education, folks in schools, high schools, universities. When you got bad weather, it's raining, can't go outside, fly the sim.
I'm surprised just wanted... it took him this long to get one of these simulators made. I know we've had the FPV ones for a while, but this is definitely needed in the drone world.
There we go.
Sorry, Sam.
We got a video popping up here, just showing like a screenshot from the software.
I do kind of want to say it looks like you have a select amount of maps that are pre-generated, warehouse, ocean type looking area. I'd say what, 5-6 maps, Paul? It seems like there is a $10 entry fee for a hobbyist and the professional version coming in, or otherwise known as the
just
full
minutes.
Version.
This simple
50.
But brilliant trick you can do tonight to eliminate.
Yeah, like Sammy said, you can see the warehouse. They've got a lot of different things that are in place. The ability to zoom in and out with the camera. You can see this scenario of taking the drone and operating the drone into a confined space. And the integration, the ability to use like a PS4 remote, a PS5, an Xbox controller, an Orca remote, so your, you know, the remote controllers that are being used for that FPV type of operation. Seeing it fly through. So what you're also seeing here is those rings. You're seeing the control input overlay. So from a standpoint of looking on and seeing from an instruction level, hey, this is what I'm doing. The student, it's hard to look at someone's hands and the sticks and the screen at the same time. So it's a great overlay. You can see the ability to get underneath, you know, gamifying it in a sense to where it keeps it captivating so that you want to continue to do and run that simulation. Because there's always an objective. If there's no purpose or there's no objective, it just becomes boring, right? There has to be a challenge there. And as you can see, you know, from a public safety aspect, if folks are operating in the public safety space, you have any kind of incident indoors, a hostage situation, a standoff situation, fires, things of that nature. Really, really neat. But those rings, and it's got that LMS, so it keeps those students, it keeps that new pilot and even that experienced pilot really engaged to want to continue to get better. What do you guys like this is amazing. It is unreal.
What's the certificate on their website? Do you know what that's about?
So that's which the airborne, the BPERP, I think that might be for a different country, APSA or the APSA NIS. So the BPERP, that's if it has to do with the airborne. Okay, so the Airborne Public Safety Association. So the NIS buckets, if folks aren't familiar with, let's see, it's the easiest way to. NIST is the National Standards Group. And what has been created is kind of like a course. Are either of you familiar with the NIST buckets? Okay.
It's like a practice kind of like course thing you can set up in your backyard or something.
It is. I'm trying to get a video.
It's really like seeing the exact angles.
I've seen some of it,
so
but I actually haven't had a chance
to control.
I was going to say I haven't personally had a chance to actually participate with that, but it's a
assess your skill improvement over time. So currently, there are five levels to get you familiar with flying close to objects and avoid hitting them while being able to capture precision images of the targets. This involves situational awareness, correct use of flight controls, and the use of gimbal and camera controls. Practicing these situations might be a little more challenging than what we did in the last video.
So it's hard to hear you.
Yeah, so you've got the buckets, and then the pilot is going to fly the drone in different, you know, locations and angles and get photographs, and their ability to kind of read the rings is determining like a proficiency, how close, how far, if it's blurry. So it's this method of training that's been developed to help pilots learn how to move and manipulate the drone and the sticks while also controlling the gimbal in order to make sure that you're seeing and capturing, you know, detailed quality imagery, if that makes sense. And you can see here, it's the actual drone screen overlaid, flying to the buckets. It's out of focus, but I don't know, this individual's head. So what they've created is like an actual standard course. And what you do is you fly that course and they can then grade the operator objectively, saying you scored a 7 out of 10 or an 8 out of 10 or a 10 out of 10. You passed or you failed. And they've developed that into this Zephyr simulator so that you can actually pay and go in and the sim can confirm or deny if you pass that scenario. And using this simulator for the advancements of like beyond visual line of sight, how can you simulate scenarios when you don't actually have to put the drone in the air in the traditional side of aviation? You know, being an instrument rated pilot, I have a handful of hours in my logbook that were conducted in a sim. There's a lot of scenarios that you want, that you would prefer to allow to play out in a simulator. There's a lot of scenarios that you can allow to play out in a simulator that you would never want to carry on in actual flight operations. You know, a full, and you can't have a full engine failure. You know, if you actually have an alternator failure, if you actually have, you know, a system failure in an aircraft in training, now all of a sudden it gets real, but you don't continue the training. So being able to simulate various things for these advanced drone operations beyond visual line of sight, especially when you're trying to simulate multiple vehicles at one time, right? Hey, we want to simulate 5 or 6 vehicles. And how do you do that? So what Zephyr's put together is really, really neat. You can take someone that's never flown a drone before and is familiar with, you know, at least remote input and comfortably introduce them to flight operations. Well said.
I was looking on the supported controllers, and it doesn't look like my drone's controller is supported, but I'm sure they'll get there.
It's also supporting multiple drones, right?
Yeah.
So they have a ton of drones that can show up in the simulator from that visual standpoint. So it kind of like the skin, right? That overlay of the drone itself.
I can imagine it's not just a skin though. I think it would handle differently too, right?
The performance characteristics, because they've created a very lifelike scenario. So if it has higher performance standards and you have various settings that you can input. And what's also neat to speak to the GPS aspect, they have the ability to put it in ADI mode. So we talk KP, solar, like, you know, you lose GPS function on your drone and now it no longer knows where it is. So they have that ability to where you can turn it
GPS off, and that drone's going to sway and move, and you're going to have to kind of constantly give corrective input. It's a really cool software. I was trying to find the list of here are supported controllers. Yeah, quite a bit there.
There's a ton. Not mine, unfortunately.
And so what you're going to end up seeing is the majority of, right, it'll be your most recent like FPV controllers, and then all of your, here, I can share this. We're just looking at the screen here of the supported controllers. You know, a lot of your traditional FPV remotes. And what's neat is you've been using these remotes plugged into a computer connected to the drone in order to program the drone itself. So when these, you know, when you're building your own, you know, FPV drone from the ground up, you know, you're actually going in, you know, most of the time, and you're saying, all right, left stick does this, right stick does this. So you're having to plug these remotes into the computer to begin with. But it's really cool. Your gamepad remote controllers, you know, Xbox 360, the PS4, PS5. I can at least go ahead.
You can use one of these bad boys on it, just a regular PlayStation 5 controller. Cool.
Yeah. And then also to say interface, I was using just like a Mac, you know, MacBook laptop, PS4 controller connected via Bluetooth, fly in, had it sharing to the TV too. So it was like this, my nephew's flying on a, you know, TV, and I'm like, all right, you know, enough, you know, you got to leave now. As he's beating my time, you know, I was like, oh, look at my 50 seconds. He's like 42. I was like, yeah, time to go, kid.
And you're done.
Later. You know, I'm the fastest pilot. Yeah.
So that's available
I walked out the.
That's available on Windows, on OS, Mac OS. I'm not sure if they're Linux, probably not, but good to know that it's on those two.
It's on Mac and Windows. I don't see anything about Linux.
And it looks like it's a separate download. I was a nerd and I checked Steam. I don't see it on the Steam page. Steam is a gaming digital platform where you can buy digital games. So simulators too, like what is the aviation simulator, Terry? Flight Simulator for Windows, Microsoft Flight Simulator.
Like,
oh.
Yeah, there we go.
Microsoft.
Took me a minute, but that's available.
So you've played this, Paul? Would you recommend it?
The Zephyr, 100%. Yeah.
Which level would you recommend?
Getting into the weeds.
So the.
I'm gonna buy whatever you say. So.
I would. Man, I mean, I would say probably the professional. Because it's going to give you like all the, you know, the obstacle courses, the hill. Like if you had Terry, how much have you flown? Like, are you a newbie?
Uh-huh.
I'm okay.
Sorry.
The Siri said, uh-huh. Are you a newbie? Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Kind of. Nah, but I'm proficient around
this. Yeah, like if you're proficient with the skills on the sticks, you know, I would say the professional, because you're going to be able to get right to the obstacle courses, the challenging fun aspects. You know, you already know that you like drones and that, you know, it's a part of, you know, your future. So I that would be my recommendation. The hobbyist level, I would say, for folks who really have never flown before, if you're in that category, where, you know, you want to get some basic training and have it teach you some of the fundamentals, in order to learn just a little bit more, you know, get started. I'm looking at it as if it's like on the screen, but,
also a free option if you just like wanted to test it out and see if you're
yep, that's what I was just looking at. So like go the free option. Make sure it works on your computer you have. Make sure you have a remote that it works with. And then once you do that and you're like, all right, you know, I've never flown before and I want to then do the one-time fee and go through the basic training. And I would be willing to bet that, well, it looks like, I'd say you could buy these individually, but kids with drones, you know, so they have some other neat little packages here. But yeah, do the beginner and get started. And then, you know, at your own pace, if you're employed, you know, you got a decent job, maybe you go for the professional if you're trying to become a professional operator. But if you're really just like, yeah, you know, I enjoy this for fun times, you know, go hobbyist.
Do you think you would recommend, like,
my recommendation
for someone to be able to, like, hey, I logged this many hours in the simulator with this aircraft? Like, do you think it's at that level yet, or do you think it's still got a little ways to go?
So that is where, you know, you are getting some of those log features. I don't know. And there is the enterprise. So from the classroom management, so for businesses or organizations, you know, you're looking at more of a learning management system to where it's kind of tracking individual user. You're making sure that the students are, you know, completing the assignments. You're making sure the employees are doing what they're supposed to. It's got all kinds of additional data collection. I don't know. I'd be curious. But I would say yes, just at a minimum, like I've always told folks, when they're flying at a hobbyist, if you're flying an airplane as a private pilot for fun, you are logging those hours. Flight experience is flight experience. Anytime an aircraft goes in the air, you are performing the same safety mitigation, the awareness, the attentiveness is always the same. It's just you're not selling data, you know, to an end user, or you're not using it to advance a business, but the safety aspect is always the same. So being able to track the sim hours is important when you interview or have those future jobs and you do sit down and you're like, yeah, you know, I've done this and I also have this many hours of doing a flight simulator. And you can create and use that what you've learned in those scenarios to say, I've done that and I'm trained to handle those situations or equipped to handle those situations.
Well, I think it's also too, is like when you're doing those simulations, you're literally kind of setting your brain up to be rewired saying, hey, you're in this mode. I need you to act this way. You're telling it because it's going to be instinctual at that point. Once you hit so many flight hours, you're not going to question what you need to do. You're going to do it, you know? And I think that's one of the reasons why it's so important. But yeah, especially showing it to an employer and being like, yeah, I definitely have enough hours for something like this, you know?
It's the muscle memory. It's exactly what you just said. It's just building the muscle memory, the stick skills. And then being able to sit down and communicate and not say you've done something you haven't, but having that knowledge and the confidence to communicate that you've been through some of those scenarios. And then challenging yourself flying through, you know, you don't want to go fly through the monkey bars in your first day with your new drone, you know, if you have never, but you have these environments where you can do things that wouldn't necessarily be entirely the safest with a lack of experience, because, you know, when you lack experience, risk goes up. How do you get experience? Well, you either do it in a safe way or you simulate it. So, and the simulation is important, because if it's crappy pixelated, if the proportions are off, if the inputs aren't right, then, and just again, and having flown it now, I'm like, no, this is it. This is going to help schools. This is going to help public safety departments. This is going to help organizations just develop experienced, confident, safe pilots. And it's fun. It's engaging, right? That's the whole part that I also think is neat.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely beneficial. I mean, would you rather spend $50 for the fully loaded game or smack your $1,500 drone into the side of a building and break it completely and wait 3 months for DJI to give it back to you.
And then the, like the improvements and the updates, it's software. So it's only going to get better. And from what I understand and what's been communicated to me, they're doing everything in-house. They're a software development company. They're a small U.S. company. They're doing everything out of the state of Virginia. They're trying to make a global impact. The state of Virginia is helping them get out there because they want to see a Virginia business not just grow in state and in the U.S., but also be able to say, hey, this is software based. We can support you remotely. This is going to help pilots, not just part 107, because it's not, this isn't part 107 based. This is actual stick flying skills. And it's cross border going to help make better, safer pilots. And with that said, we can kind of roll into a final segment. The looking at dronelife.com here, article came out yesterday. Participate in the Drone 2 Global Drone Industry Survey, Shaping the Future Together. So this here is a survey. It's going to be open to businesses and organizations globally. Since 2018, launched, so a 910 drones has launched, great year, 2018. This has been going out, and what it is, it's taking input. It's the 7th annual global drone industry survey. So operators, small companies, big companies alike can complete this survey, and all that information is compiled. There's going to be, for people who complete the survey, they're going to be giving away and not people, businesses, right? Organizations, drone giveaway, some global drone event passes as far as like Amsterdam Drone Week, commercial UAV. So participating in this survey puts you in the runnings for some pretty neat stuff. It helps the industry grow when folks are giving insightful information. So if you are part of an organization or know somebody that is working with a drone company anywhere across the globe, share this with them so that, this information can come in and the industry can benefit from, what's working and what's not working.
And where can people fill that out?
There's a link here on the dronelife.com website. So folks, for anyone are able that to get to dronelife.com.
Right.
Yep. So anyone operating drone businesses, small businesses or large businesses, go ahead, get yourself in here for the runnings for an Avada 2 FPV drone. Super cool drone.
I know where I'm going after this.
Super, super cool drone. The one last thing, public safety folks, UAS operators in the public safety space, where are we at? There is going to be right there tomorrow. Tune in on YouTube for Media Advisory, Homeland Security. Media Advisory Chairman D. Esposito Pfluger announced hearing on the impact of drones, emerging technology on law enforcement.
You said tune in tomorrow.
Tomorrow at 10 a.m.
This is coming out probably Friday or so for this will already be out.
So, well, yeah, right. I see what you're saying there. So what's happening is as far as this will come out, right? So Thursday, this week, May 16th, there's going to be a subcommittee hearing on drones and the use, the impact on emergency response. So
this is really significant here for lawmakers and folks to really get out there and start promoting at a large scale how drones are advancing that emergency response. And it's really interesting because we have the FAA Reauthorization Act, which has put the, you know, 4-month, you know, very short time period on the proposed rulemaking for beyond visual line of sight. Beyond visual line of sight flight operations are going to drastically advance the way public safety operators, you know, integrate this technology by having rapid deployment of, you know, pre-positioned drones that are ready to go at a moment's notice. So you have all this really coming together at the same time where folks are going to get up there and they're going to start to say at a very high level, not, oh, this threat, that threat, China this, you know, US this, we need this. But just to say in general, hopefully, what I hope we hear is just a generalized drones are saving people's lives. And for that to be heard, not from delivery or, you know, real estate and how great and all the CGE, the growth rates and the numbers and the dollars, but to actually hear that this is saving lives, red, blue, it's non-discriminatory. Drones are helping everybody. So it's really neat to know that this is coming up and this is going to be part of a conversation this week.
Definitely exciting.
And Terry, you got the ACLU chatting it up, protecting your rights. Everybody's talking.
Yeah, should be an interesting hearing.
Yeah. Any other thoughts in closing here?
Kind of excited to see where that goes.
Wrap up
a few companies are currently doing beyond visual line of sight, but from my understanding, they're not getting compensation with that. It's kind of like a trial period, right?
Well, there's difference. And then I thought I was sharing the screen the whole time as I was talking, but what's really cool, YouTube. So it's going to be at like 10 a.m. But how cool is YouTube? You can watch it live, but it's going to be right there to watch. So I'm looking forward to actually, you know, popping some popcorn, you know, late Thursday night and just watching the Committee on Homeland Security discuss drones. But you said the delivery aspect beyond visual line comment. So I think the beyond visual line of sight that they're talking about pushing forward is not the delivery aspect, because the delivery, if you're going to carry someone's goods for compensation or higher, you're, you know, from what I understand and I see long term, short term, mid term, that's part 135. The FAA Reauthorization Act, which we can dive into, you know, on next week's episode. So go ahead and read up that beyond visual line of sight push is for your non package carrying, your drone as a first responder, your pipeline inspection, your transmission inspection, your environmental analysis, you know, not the carrying of consumer goods.
I do feel like it was kind of that gentle first step, though, being like, hey, you know, you guys try this out. Let us know what you think. Let's see if anything blows up and, you know, we'll see. It's a test run, you know? And since nothing has extensively blown up or there's been no major incidences, it's kind of opening that door up to the smaller individual folks who want to do this, you know? And that's specifically why I brought that up, but.
And that is too, because you can't really just allow this to happen in this space and say, well, it's okay. And this is why, and then not also lay out the framework for one person to just do it over here for something that's a little bit different. So as much as people have been frustrated over the last few years saying, well, how come these companies can do it and this and that? It's because they've been, you know, putting a lot of resources into helping, you know, determine what technologies, you know, what systems, what needs to be in place, not just for an individual to do this, but for a large organization. And everybody knows the one individual is always like, you only want going to be an individual for so long. And then all of a sudden, like, oh, you know, let me hire one other person. And let me, and now all of a sudden you're like, oh, we got 40 people and 10 sites and this, and we have no standards. We have no training. We have no records. That's what the FAA has been, in my opinion, you know, taking a progressive crawl, walk, run approach in order to make sure that you don't end up in those scenarios where it's like, oh my gosh, what happened? These things grew too fast. So yeah, lots happening at all different levels, at the federal level, states levels, you know, Michigan Supreme Court's handling drone cases, the FAA Reauthorization Act is getting pushed. We've got congressional hearings on the value of drones in emergency response. It's really cool. It's a great time to be in the drone industry. So for anybody who just joined today, welcome. And anyone who's been here, you know exactly what to expect. And that's, you don't know what to expect. No. So
one thing, Tony Brocco used to,
everybody,
I was just going to say, when I was with Tony Brocco, worked with him in the past before. And, something we had is drone industry, something new every day. Cause like it's rapidly evolving. There's a lot of stuff going on. So that just my closing remarks there.
And it covers the Milkman FPV, Tony Brocco. That's the amazing part too about the drones is that they overlap so many arenas. So it's not just outside. It's not just inside. It's now just not visual line of sight. It's this industry. It's that industry. And all these industries are integrating drones differently. And that just creates just so much rapid development and really interesting things happening on that daily level. So appreciate everybody tuning in. We had a chance to talk a little bit more about the space weather and what's happening there. And it'll be exciting to kind of see as folks continue to go, well, we need this, we need this, we need this. And that becomes more part of the conversation and people start to realize how, you know, there's a huge connection between what's happening in low Earth orbit and space and how we live our daily lives. The possibility of an Army drone branch, really neat, intriguing, probably needed in order to not just bring small drones to the front lines, but also the counter drone technology that's going to help keep our soldiers safe from a defense standpoint. Tech side, we talked about the Zephyr flight simulator, really awesome, really cool, innovative. You know, they've got that free option. Go check it out, download it, make sure you've got some compatible equipment. And let us know what you think about the simulator itself. Check out the drone industry survey. If you own, operate a business, work for a company that wants to help provide that information and get in the runnings for some neat prizes, get you out to one of these drone events, expos, conventions. Regulations, Subcommittee on Emergency Management and Technology. That's going to be really interesting to kind of see where that conversation goes. And then next week, we'll hopefully take a little bit more time to maybe unpack the FAA Reauthorization Act. And really appreciate everybody tuning in. And please, reach out. Any questions, Paul Rossi at 910drones.com. You can also reach out to Miriam at dronelife.com with any questions, suggestions that you have for future episodes. We appreciate you tuning in. Make sure to check out dronelife.com throughout the week to stay updated on what's happening in the drone industry. We will see you next week. Appreciate everyone's time and attention. Fly safely.